Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we're focusing on big, as in large, idea, as in idea and the future and nutrition, books. First up, we've got Steve Ritz, a.k.a. the Green Bronx Machine, who will tell us about the power of a plant.
You know you're on the right track when the person you're about to interview says, I'm coming to Pittsburgh tomorrow, and I'm going to visit three schools, and I'm going to be the keynote speaker at a special event. Stephen Ritz.
Founder of Green Bronx Machine.
But you didn't start out famous, so how did you become so famous?
Well, let's mention his book, first of all.
I think there are three words involved: passion, purpose, and hope, and I am relentlessly optimistic. And I think if you bring your A-game daily, amazing things will happen. And that's what this movement is all about. You know, I still can't believe I'm Steve Ritz. But hard work pays off, and that's what this movement is about. Harvesting minds and cultivating hope. Growing something greater than any of us ever imagined simply by putting a seed in the ground. That is the power of a plant.
Okay, and that is the title of your book, which explains your whole journey here. Which you refer to as an odyssey, or did somebody else refer to it as an odyssey?
No, I refer to it as an odyssey. Who knew? I mean, who knew, you know, 35 years ago that I would be here today talking to you en route to the beautiful city of Pittsburgh tomorrow to visit three schools and speak at the Inspire series. But it goes to show you, if you show up, grow up, bring your body, your brain will follow, and amazing things can happen.
And that's what you told your students. How about let's introduce this thing? I loved your introduction of how you were going for this job interview.
Well, literally, you know, I started teaching in the early 1980s when the South Bronx was not what it looks like today. It was in the midst of absolute decay, and, you know, crack, crime, and cocaine were consuming lives daily, and I was stuck in the middle of a school system that was both separate and unequal, where children were apart from success and apart from, you know, a larger society. And I myself had no idea that I would ever become a teacher. It was all an accident. You know, I jokingly say I'm still waiting for the MBA to call me back. I've kind of settled on the fact that it probably won't happen. I'm still optimistic. This may be my last year of hope. But, you know, if you show up and talk to children and treat them with love and respect, amazing things can happen, and that's what I've been determined to do from the day I walked through the doors.
But you are an inspired teacher by nature, I think.
Well, I'm an inspired individual. I'm the oldest sixth grader you're ever going to meet. So, you know, the whole notion of project-based learning and doing anything fun and creative is inherently kind of exciting to me. You know, I believe that no child rises to low expectations, so every day that I get up and pull some air into my lungs and my head extends towards the sun, and I can put 2 feet on the ground or at least one and hop the rest of the way, I'm inspired to make epic happen and do something great. So to your point, I guess I am an inspired teacher, but I'm an inspired person. I'm inspired by children. I'm inspired by the world. I'm inspired by every single thing I see around me, and I just want to leave the world a little bit better than I found it.
Well, I mean, if your instincts were also right, how wrong could everything have gone, too, given the circumstances?
Well, I think, you know, now more than ever, we have turned our children into profit centers for corporations and entities. And we've got to stop looking at our children as that and start realizing that what First Lady Michelle Obama said, how we treat our children is indicative of who we are as a society. But with the educational crisis growing, with the obesity crisis and hunger across the globe growing, and the fact that now more than ever obesity is the face of hunger, and the rest of these children are shunted, stunted, and in pain, both sides of that coin to me are wholly unacceptable. And for me, the only way we're ever going to end poverty is really by increasing access to quality and inclusive education. So the fact that I can grow food in schools using 90% less water and 90% less space in a community that has limited means and limited access to it is absolutely spectacular to me. Plus, we get to eat it. How cool is that?
Yeah, and you said a healthy diet. You lost 100 pounds.
I myself lost over 110 pounds simply by eating the food that I grow with children in school. But it's part and parcel of what I say is a community that in many ways is a food swamp. You know, people like to talk about a food desert. I think that's a media term. I like to say communities like mine are a food swamp. They're right. filled with incredibly bad choices, you know, based on an extraction economy, based on a pharmaceutical economy where, you know, we're taking the health and wealth of a community and exploiting it and sending it far away and leaving death, disease, and dis-ease in its wake. And, you know, my community, most things they eat are what I call a mess. A manufactured edible synthetic substance. We've gotten so far removed from what food is and where it comes from that, you know, we forget our true roots. But think about this. Without farmers, we'd all be naked and hungry. And that's a thought here in New York City I just don't want to imagine.
You know, you have some, what, 5 pages of endorsements from some people such as Marion Nestle and who was the other one I noticed? It was amazing. And you're quoted by Michael Pollan. You really are networked into that whole community of eat real food, not too much, mostly plants, right?
That's for sure. If it comes from a plant, don't eat it. If it's made in a plant, don't eat it.
If it comes from a plant,
do eat it. And, you know, while I'm humbled by the accolades so many luminaries in the field have, you know, bestowed upon me and bestowed upon the book, The Power of the Plant, and I hope it compels everybody to read it, what I'm most proud of is my students. As I like to say, 50,000 pounds of vegetables later, my favorite crop is organically grown citizens, graduates, members of the middle class, kids who are growing and eating their way into good health and outstanding academic performance, kids who are going to college, kids who know and demand healthy, fresh food. And who aren't dependent on medication.
I really think that you should clone yourself because you wrought a miracle in the school that you started. Give our listeners the backstory. I mean, you were right out of college. You really wanted to play basketball, but you didn't have it, right?
Right. The NBA had a whole different plan for that.
Yeah.
You know? I still take umbrage with them, but I've since forgiven them. I've moved on.
Yeah, but so you were confronting now this impoverished school. It's also the children were what were they called? I lost the word. But I mean, it was not even it was not a normal school. It was not an average school. It was a below average school and a below average class. Right.
No, absolutely. I mean, sadly, back then, to be a weatherman, to know which way the wind blows, so to speak. So to teach in a community like mine, much less work in a community like mine, much less live in a community like mine, you know, I have this fundamental belief that children should not have to leave their neighborhood to live, learn, and earn a better one. And productive schools and productive people generate productive, resilient communities. And it was abundantly obvious to me that Superman was not coming to the South Bronx. There was no man on the white horse, no Wonder Woman coming to our community. Remarkably, my students and I, we are the ones that we were waiting for. And, you know, we weren't asking for a handout, but rather a hand up. And somehow found it within ourselves to grow something greater. And that's the beauty of passion, purpose, of hope, of endless and boundless optimism. That's what the story, The Power of a Plant, is all about, that a seed well planted can give you a crop of epic proportions. So while I am somewhat of a farmer, I like to say I'm very much a people farmer, and my children represent seeds. And seeds, to me, represent unlimited genetic potential, and it's my job to help my children and my colleagues reach their God-given genetic potential and to grow a crop of epic proportions.
Now relate the story that you described, that moment of the teaching moment of truth about the bulbs that you thought were onions.
So
I mean, that's kind of how it starts, right?
Yes. Well, I mean, there are so many moments, but that's certainly a stellar one where I had inherited this class of 17 overage high school students, the bulk of whom were reading at second and third grade level. With the average age of about 18. And what happened is remarkable. You know, I had suffered some personal tragedies in my own life. My wife and I lost some children. I had buried some of my students just months prior and just took a job at a new school wanting to get away from the pain and the memories of my old school. Just couldn't walk through that door another day and relive those memories. So I took a job at what was the worst school in New York City. To add some context to that, we had 256 felonies committed in that building. We had a police precinct in the school. That's a high school. No child should have to go to school like that. We had 48 school safety officers in that school, 18 armed policemen, and 18 full-time deans of discipline. Think about that, what that means from a cost perspective, from an administrative aspect. Certainly not a school, more like a holding facility. And lo and behold, you know, I made incredible contact and connections with these children, made them feel a part of instead of apart from. And remarkably, one day I get this call to the principal's office, you know, through the PA. Mr. Riggs, come to the principal's office.
Yeah, I've had those calls myself.
The sound of the secretary's voice. And literally I'm thinking, am I in trouble? What have I done now? How? What could this be? I show up in the principal's office, and there's the secretary with a big box. And she's, Mr. Riggs, you have a present. And there I am, like the oldest sixth grader in the building, getting excited. I see this big box, and I'm like, this is going to be awesome. I can't wait to see what this thing is. Maybe it's microscopes. Maybe it's sports equipment. Maybe it's a telescope. Maybe it's some kind of robot kit. Who knows? But I was surely excited, so excited that I couldn't wait to get to my classroom to open it, and opened it literally in the hallway right outside the principal's office like a crazy kid on a Christmas morning. Only to open up and see hundreds of these little round things that looked like onions. I had no idea what they were, but boy, oh boy, was I disappointed. And I was like, man, this is the worst thing in the world this teacher could have gotten, because the children, they're going to throw these at me. I saw those as weapons. And I took the box back to class without saying a word, with a long frown on my face, and hid it behind an old radiator near an open window, and let it sit there until 6 weeks later, when there was a fight in my class and this girl got up to go beat the crap out of some little skinny kid who just wouldn't stop taunting her. And instantly I saw my career ending. A 200-pound girl chasing after a little boy, you know, who's really a big pain, who probably deserved a good whack, but certainly not the whack she was intending to give him. I saw him reach under the radiator, thinking, oh, my God, here comes a weapon. And again, there went my career. And lo and behold, the box opened up, and all these flowers fell out. These daffodils. Well, I didn't even know they were daffodils. I learned afterwards. But literally, all these flowers fell out. The young boy starts waving them in front of this girl, and that's what we call, and everyone started laughing, but the fight stopped, and that's what I call in the South Bronx a teachable moment. So we went on that year to plant 15,000 bulbs across New York City to commemorate 9/11, taking over abandoned lots and parks and playgrounds, planting flowers and bulbs, and learning about ornamental horticulture. And the beginning of something great was sown, and that was the start.
But you yourself knew nothing about farming, right?
I knew nothing about flowers. 10 years, I couldn't tell you 10 kinds of fresh fruit and vegetables. Now I grow 37 kinds of fresh fruits and vegetables indoors in my class, using 90% less space, using 90% less water, in the middle of the housing project in the poorest congressional district in all of America, in the least healthy county in all of New York State, in the poorest performing school district within New York City.
Yeah. But
and I grow them 52 weeks a year, I might add. Pretty cool.
Say there were 50 people who had that same experience, and even if they recognized it as the seed of an idea, they wouldn't have been able to run with it. I mean, your personality and your sense of mission really kicked in to make this an exceptional program.
Well, I am impact-driven. I am purpose-driven for sure. But that is the story, the power of the plant, and I think one of the beauties of the book is it literally gives anybody a playbook. I like to say the book is part perspiration, part inspiration, 100% motivation, but literally it's a playbook how anybody, anywhere can make epic happen in their own life, in their own community, and most importantly, how we can touch the lives of children to reclaim and redirect this country to a much better place.
Now,
that to me is what my work is all about.
Now, Stephen, it wasn't 100% straightforward as you're describing it. I glanced at one page in the book, and it says something about a place called the Rubber Room.
I am an insurgent educator, so make no doubt about that. I am an absolute insurgent. Just like Pee Wee Herman, Dottie, I'm a rebel. So I'm not into incremental change. I'm into whole systems change, and I believe that we can do this. Sometimes it means taking a bullet on the chin. Sometimes the high poppy gets clipped. But you know what? I am endlessly resourceful and endlessly resilient. And I like to say I keep falling up the ladder of success.
But tell our listeners about the rubber room.
Well, I refuse to. The rubber room is a place where teachers are sent for either incompetence or noncompliance. And I was, in fact, noncompliant. I refused to falsify test scores. I had a lot of information on a particular principal at a particular time that could be very damaging to her career. And she, in fact, invented some charges against me that were proven false. I went to the rubber room, but I got out real quick. You know, justice was served, and I went on to start a program that has far exceeded the legacy of her failed attempt to diminish my credibility. And that's what this is about, resilience, perseverance, growing something greater, that a seed well planted can give you a crop of epic proportions, the power of a plant.
Right.
Listen, I can't build new schools. I don't have $1 million. You know, I'm a full-time volunteer at the work I do, which is rather remarkable in and of itself. But I do have the ability to put a plant in every single classroom that I enter. I do have the ability to put a seed in every child's hand and make a promise that when you put a seed in a child's hand, that plant, that seed will become a plant. I have the ability to give something effortlessly and freely. It's called love. And that's something that we have long since forgotten about in this country. Love, the power of a role model, the power of someone being there, and all the data points to one thing that people like to forget, that children who have access to one kind, caring adult in life will be successful. So I am determined to be that kind, caring adult for as many children as possible, as many colleagues as possible, as many communities as possible. And that, you know, with passion, purpose, and hope, and replicable, scalable technology aligned to good pedagogy, and every now and then a good hug, along with sometimes a not-so-gentle kick in the behind in a positive way, you can make epic happen.
Now, what's your slogan? Again, let's do that again.
My slogan is, Si se puede, which means, yes, we can. It turned out that was what Barack Obama ran his campaign on, and I was just thrilled to learn those are the famous words of our beloved Cesar Chavez from the United Farm Workers, which is even more important to me considering I'm growing healthy students. But, you know, I was very inspired by President Obama and Mrs. Obama. I remember when Mrs. Obama started talking about healthy food and what we're feeding our children is absolutely critical to us. As I tipped the scales at over 300 pounds, that I too could change my way. And, you know, literally I farmed, my students and I have farmed ourselves to the White House several times, including an invitation to South by South Lawn. We have a great picture of it in the book, A Power of a Plant. I have a great picture of my kids and I doing amazing things, and that's what this is about. Everybody has the potential to make epic happen in their lives. We just have to seize the moment.
Now, you've talked so far about the children and the schools. Have you sensed that what you're doing is making a difference to the whole community in the South Bronx?
I mean, tell you this. We've moved targeted attendance from 40% attendance to 93% attendance. We've had year after year of 100% graduation rate. We've transformed the school culture. We've helped partner towards 2,200 local jobs. So a community that has some of the highest rates of unemployment and chronic unemployment and underemployment, to move children into 2,200 jobs, that's game-changing, as I like to say, from hope to the Pope. And, in fact, I was invited to meet Pope Francis 2 years ago and even got to meet His Holiness in the back.
Nice picture of you with the Pope.
Well, the Pope, he's just a rock star, let me tell you.
He looks happy, Pope. And he's smiling, very different from the picture of him standing next to the Trumps.
Well, don't even get me started on him.
Don't get me started either.
You used a bad word there. And think about this. When you teach children in the least likely place to embrace nature, you teach them to nurture. And when we teach children to nurture, we as a society collectively embrace our better nature. And that's what this movement is all about. Grow something greater and create a greater global good.
Now, you call it a movement. You have an organization. It's Green Bronx Machine.
Yes, our organization is called Green Bronx Machine. You can visit us on the web at www.greenbronxmachine.org. You can like the children on Facebook. They have an outrageous Facebook page called Green Bronx Machine. You can visit me on the web at StephenRitz.com or Stephen Ritz on Facebook or on Twitter. We're like to say we're everywhere.
Well, what are the
we're taking over the world.
I mean, I'm one of two things. One, how does the organization work? And two, what's its geographical reach?
Well, the organization is 100% volunteer. In fact, the proceeds from the book are going to support the organization. We are literally touching schools across America and around the world. We're scaling in Canada. I was recently in Latin America. I've been as far as Cairo. Next month I'll be in Germany. So I think the notion of growing healthy students, healthy schools, and healthy communities is something that appeals to everybody. But we don't take any salaries, but we do depend on people's support. So if you like what you hear, get out there and buy a copy of a book, The Power of a Plant. Know that the proceeds are going to support the program, helping to build infrastructure and provide food and educational programs to children in schools all around the world.
Stephen, you're an inspiration.
You sure are.
Thank you kindly.
You've made our day. I hope you get a few people in Pittsburgh to join your program too.
If anybody's in Pittsburgh, I can't wait to shout out. Let me shout out Langley Middle School, one of my favorites. I'll be at the Inspire Speaker Series tomorrow night in Pittsburgh, thanks to the Green Building Alliance and my dear friend Jenna Kramer. So thank you so much, but most importantly, please pick up a copy of the book, The Power of a Plant by Stephen Ritz, and check out our website and grow something greater. But remember, listeners, you have the power to make epic happen. So as we say in the South Bronx, si se puede. God bless you.
Who knew that one person could make a huge difference?
Yes, indeed.
Really,
it's true.
Really remarkable fellow. No question about it, Mr. Ritz. And what he's achieved is amazing, and he's not stopping.
Nope.
Not the least little bit. In fact, we mentioned it in the interview. I think he said, tomorrow I'm going to be in Pittsburgh. Talking to some people about trying to do the same thing in Pittsburgh as he did in the Bronx. So anyway, we'll be right back with more big ideas right after the break. So don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And so here we are again, and next up is Nick Barnard, his AKA and his wife's would be Rude Health. The book is entitled Eat Right, and we should all be doing that, shouldn't we?
We should, and here's how.
Nick Barnard, you're something of a genius when it comes to eating right, which is the name of your book is Eat Right. Let's start by tell our listeners what you mean by rude health.
That's a very good and important introductory question, because the food company that I began with my wife 11 years ago in London is called Rude Health. And we chanced upon this name because it's an old English expression meaning to be up for life. And not that everybody in the streets of London greets each other in the morning and says, you know, how are you? They don't say, as you might in Ireland, top of the morning. And they don't suddenly turn around and say, I'm in rude health. The principle is that to be in rude health is to be positive and to have your cup overflowing rather than half full. And the food company, the food and drinks company that we established, has a principle of truly generous understanding of what it takes to provide nourishment to our customers. So all our foods are exciting eating as well as nourishing eating. And in many ways, over the last two or three generations, we've been led astray by following indulgence over nourishment. But you can have both. And so Root Health, this is a company, a small family company. We're based in Fulham in southwest London, where we have a cafe on the New King's Road called, strangely enough, the Rude Health Cafe, embodies what it means to be positive about making choices about eating. And our strapline is if you eat right, you'll stay brilliant. And so the book is called Eat Right.
Now, let's talk a little bit about your premise is that our ancestors ate right. And you talked about, well, they did eat, I would say, real food. But, I mean, it was because there wasn't any other options, right?
Yes, I mean, in many ways, you put your finger on it, because the idea that you could have 24/7 availability of convenient food and drinks that were satiating largely through indulgence was a complete misnomer, wasn't it? I mean, in times past, less than two generations ago, homeowners, homekeepers, kitchen, those in the kitchen were preoccupied with finding food at all.
Exactly.
You know, it was feast and famine, or it was constantly being concerned about sourcing food. And we now live in these lavish times where we're confused about what to eat. And in times past, our ancestors were concerned about what to find to eat. And then they made it go a long way. They eked out the nourishment and the true appreciation for food. In other words, they had a conscious relationship with food.
Right.
Now they have a conscious relationship with Tesco and Sainsbury's.
Well, I think Marks and Spencer's. I think the world over, it doesn't matter whether it's a retailer's name or what it is, it's a relationship with, it isn't a relationship, it's actually, it's not really a relationship with a retailer anyway, because the consumers are becoming so promiscuous. They'll shop wherever it takes them, if it's to follow their wallet or it's to follow their taste buds or to make better decisions that have a responsible relationship with food. I think what's happened is that we have a complete disconnect with the intimate and conscious relationship with food as God's given, nature's rich endowment to us, that we think is no longer, which we now consider to be a right that is cheap and plentiful and convenient. Well, you can have what is in effect ancestrally inexpensive food. You know, if you buy a chicken and you roast it and you use it to make broth or stock, and you can eke out a chicken for four or five meals. That is conscious, initiative, and responsible eating, rather than purchasing only chicken breasts and eating the white meat, the prime cuts of animals, and then throwing the rest away.
I think that the chicken breast is, you mentioned here something about the only value it is caloric, non-caloric, or something like that, you said.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it has no flavor whatsoever.
If you were in China or in parts of Asia, the chicken breast is the rubbish meat. And indeed, if you think about it, our ancestors would never eat chickens. They'd eat they'd celebrate special occasions with a fat hen. Mm-hmm. They might eat a scrawny rooster. But they would never be breeding chickens as meat birds, because a chicken dummy, you know, lays eggs.
They lay eggs, right.
And eggs from, you know, pastured chickens are nutritionally more or less complete. And we become obsessed with low-cost convenience. And I think the word convenience has really destroyed a conscious relationship with food, because we now are worried if we can't eat fast enough, or we can't get our food on the table fast enough in a restaurant, or we're too busy to shop or to bring out the best in food, whether it's by simple fermentation or sprouting or just an appreciation for selecting the producers of food who really take responsibility for what they do.
Now, you have a lot of information on sprouting and fermentation. It seems to be really everybody's concerned with that and preserving now. And I'm not sure if it's just because people like the flavors, they like having to do it. But do they really appreciate how important nutrition-wise fermentation is for your gut biome, for example?
I think, you know, you put that last point you made is actually the critical aspect of what you've described. We have pursued convenient food, for the most part, has been dead. And we have been buying food cheaply that lasts a long time, has a long shelf life. And the reason that most foods have a long shelf life in this day and age is because they have been treated with, either endowed with preservatives or ultra-high temperature pasteurized or controlled so that they are resistant to decomposition. Your entire gut biome is there to break down
exactly.
and release nutrients. If you lock them up in food that has an unnaturally long shelf life, you are giving your gut biome a hard time.
Yeah.
And that's why so many people are complaining of either what they might describe as intolerances or aversions to foods that our ancestors would traditionally have either fermented or sprouted or activated or cultured or whatever, however you describe it, they would never have eaten the food. They would be appalled to see how much, dead food we eat. Appalled. And the next decade is, and indeed we're seeing it now, we're going to see a return to a respect for bringing the best out of food so that our overwhelming population of bacteria in our bodies becomes more diverse.
Yes.
And therefore serves us better in the digestion of food that hasn't been destroyed to make it convenient.
Now this book is fascinating on a number of different levels. But the thing I found the most interesting is that you go really, and you have a page, I think it's either a yellow or an orange page, which talks about the fact that British soil is dead.
Yeah.
And I think you snuck in there the American South, which you just visited, has centuries of monoculture as well.
Yes.
And I mean, these both worry you a lot.
It is a real concern, because if you think about it, your biome, your gut biome, is suffering and has suffered through relentless mediocrity and dead food, and has become compromised. We have produced food and compromised the world's, the nature, the planet's biome, which is the soil biome, and the soil is the gut. You know, it's the digestive organism of the Earth and of our planet. I'm not talking about the oceans. I'm talking about the Earth, you know, as in the land mass. And we have treated it as if it is a mineable, as if we can mine it. Well, nature doesn't work like that. And not only have we reduced the amount of soil, but fundamentally, the organic, in other words, the rich living matter or the rich organism-rich environment of the soil. But we've also reduced the nutritional quality of the soil. And this was appreciated back in the 1930s by farmers in Germany, which is how biodynamics and the organic movement began.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And we're 100 years later, and we're beginning to come round full circle again, having been saved by the Second World War and the production of ammonium nitrate fertilizers, which gave the apparition, this false, this complete and utter misunderstanding that the Green Revolution was sustainable. Whereas, in fact, ammonium nitrate feeds the plants. It kills the soil organisms.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
horrifying to think of, actually.
It's horrifying to think of it, because we have abused the soil. And in marginal ecosystems, parts of Texas, parts of Africa, and a marginal ecosystem is where what has grown there has taken thousands of years to grow. You know, it's rather like Iceland. You know, the Vikings arrived, chopped down the trees, and thought, oh, they're not going to grow again in my lifetime. And these are marginal ecosystems where you have to be, they're fragile and they're delicate. And we've assumed that by the use of intensive agriculture with all the accompanying chemicals and invasive techniques, and all that we're really doing is creating an environment where the soil acts as a prop, you know, rather like you're putting it in a metal superstructure. You're just planting these plants in and then feeding the plants. That doesn't give nourishment to either nature and therefore, or fundamentally us, because the fundamental outcome of Eat Right is that we, believe it or not, are nature. We are of nature, And anything we do to nature harms, that is detrimental to nature, fundamentally ends up harming us, because we are part of that organism. And the soil, and what happened in Britain is that there was a little feature in the Farmers Weekly, which is the weekly farmer's rag magazine, saying researchers in Newcastle University or wherever it was have realized that really, and this is in God's great, you know, rural, and you know, this is a green and pleasant land, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, that we've only got 70 harvests left. It didn't raise any eyebrows at all. Didn't raise any eyebrows.
It's really awful, huh? But this is one aspect of what you wrote. But let's not forget the other part, which is called How to Eat Right Because the Food is Really Tasty.
Yeah, but I had a question.
Oh, go ahead.
I really don't want to skip over this. I mean, I might warn you that my great uncle was a dairy farmer, and I used to spend summers in Guernsey County, Ohio. I'm questioning the whole, I mean, I understand that it may taste better, raw milk, but I remember the great relief that pasteurization brought to farmers, and dairy farmers in particular, and to the people consuming the products.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of a powder keg of a discussion that's going to take a lot of fleshing out, because let's not forget that in times past, fundamentally, we as Anglo-Saxons, largely derived from Anglo-Saxons, Western European stock, can digest milk.
Yeah, whereas a lot of people cannot, yeah.
Yeah, we're in a minority on this planet. So I'm not going to get het up about raw milk across the world. Uh-uh. I'm just going to say that those who can tolerate raw milk, if they have access to clean and certified raw milk, they should have availed themselves of it, because it tastes fabulous, it's easy to digest, and it is... if you leave it on the kitchen counter, after 3 or 4 days, 5 days, it will have turned into curds and whey, it will have soured. If I leave my pasteurized milk on the side in the kitchen, it will putrefy.
You're right.
I want food that is safe and clean. And milk is a food. Mm-hmm. I want milk, and I want food that is safe and clean, and that has come from a good, virile agricultural environment that is sustainable and regenerative, not just sustainable, but regenerative. In other words, the agricultural practice has to encourage and enrich the fertility and the productivity, the actual quality of the produce. Now, in times past, our ancestors would have milk cows, and how they worked and lived in their agricultural cycle was very much a mixed farm, small farmers, and with the arrival of the larger dairy herds and the urbanization and all of the economic pressures that brought, it became impossible to control dairy farmers down to the farm gate level to meet the standards for the long-distance transportation of milk into the cities. And therefore, pasteurization was introduced as a godsend.
Right.
But at the time, and I will make this absolutely clear, everybody knew at the time it would be a temporary measure, while farm practices, particularly the availability of clean and potable water for the animal, and hygiene, which is a luxury, were improved. But instead, with the rise of the shift of the power from the farmer to the dairy, and the dairy controlled the pasteurization processes and the secondary production of cheese and butter, they were reluctant to give up their ability to control the pricing and the profit margins on dairy produce. And that's where we are today. And the raw milk movement in America sets the standard for the rest of the world, in many states, and in other states it's a relentless battle, to give people the choice. Nobody buys raw milk unwittingly. You don't go to the shop and say, oh, I accidentally bought raw milk.
No, no.
If you make a conscious decision and the regulatory authorities have the right controls over the quality of the farming practice and the hygiene on the farm, then empirically, producing, and you know this, you love raw milk cheese, don't you?
Yes.
You bet we do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there you are. You want your access to raw milk cheese. I want my access to raw cream and raw butter, raw milk butter. Raw cream butter, animal milk, and I want to make that conscious decision by being a grown-up adult.
And guess where we had both of those things just within the last few days?
Exactly.
Where you're speaking to us right now.
Well, you are, and how lucky you are to have that choice. Nobody is going to unwittingly become ill from raw milk because they will make the conscious decision to buy it. Now, one of the fastest growing commercial aspects of dairy nowadays, dairy farming, is micro dairies, particularly in Britain, where farmers realize that if they sell bulk, you know, if they produce and send their milk to go to the dairy for pasteurization, homogenization, all the other things they do to it, they get pennies in the pound they get 20 pence a litre. If they become certified and they're inspected 5 times or 10 times more than a regular dairy farmer who has their milk pasteurized, then you will find that they will gain such margin in selling their produce and pride because you're buying the milk from that farmer. I buy my milk in Notting Hill Market in London from Dave Paul of Hurdlebrook. He's a purebred Guernsey farmer, and his milk is delicious. He's inspected so regularly it hurts. He is in control of his herd. He's intimate with his herd. I know what I'm buying from him. He has produced. If I buy from a dairy, it could have been from 30 farms.
And now let's go back to Peter pointed something that's very important. I want to slide in something to say that the illustrations in your book are absolutely magnificent. And seeing these don't make you hungry, I'd be rather surprised.
Turn back a couple of pages. I mean, look at that. Look at that beef shank dish.
Yes. I mean, I was blessed by having a dream team to put this book together. I mean, I've written, 18 books, but this is my first cookbook, and other books have been about tribal art and Indian art and so on. But having been a founder with my wife of Root House for the last 11 years, I've been immersed in food, but I carried with me the visual quality that I brought to my other books that I wanted to bring to this book. And so Jenny Zarin, the photographer, I give her full tribute to the extraordinary natural and evocative photography, which, as you say, puts the food where it should be. You know, it's consciously desirable. And each of those foods there, whether they're delicious, none of them are miserably healthy. Because at the end of the day, all food ought to be health-giving. It's what you do to it that makes it more or less nourishing. And I think that the inspiration for people to see that is that you can do all those recipes. You know, I'm an old bloke. If I can cook any of those recipes, anybody can.
Yeah, well, the deliciousness of the recipes is what Peter was commenting on. And I think that for anybody to buy the book, they want to know that these recipes are, some of them are just so brilliantly delicious. Now I'm trying to find the one that I like with the navy beans and, well, you know which one I'm talking about.
Yeah, I think that's
sauerkraut. The sauerkraut.
Oh, it's yes. I mean, I'm a big fan of robust. I mean, at the end of the day, we all know this. Raw milk cheese tastes wonderful because it's full of, you know, it's nutrient dense. A carrot plucked from your allotment, from your farmstead, from your garden, fresh, washed, eaten, it's a different vegetable than the carrot, even when it's organic, that's been around 3 depots in a chilled supply chain. And nutrient density in food is what brings flavor.
It's a lot of work. I mean, we have a garden, but my mother was a brilliant gardener, and we've never matched that since she died. I mean, it was like organic gardener, you know. It takes a lot of work.
But don't forget, you know, when people talk about being time poor, I'm sorry to be in rude health, but I'm going to tell you now, I think that's a shame that they should fall back on the excuse of time poor, because if you think about it, if you had a sprouting jar and some mung beans, mm-hmm. and you sprouted those mung beans, it would take you 5 to 10 minutes of a 4 or 5 day cycle to produce sprouted mung beans to make a salad.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a problem for somebody time poor, is it? It's an attitude problem. It's, I can do this if I take the trouble, and I realize how important it is, how important it is to be consciously sourcing and getting the best out of foods in a responsible way.
All right. Well, one of these, the thing I was talking about, the recipe I'm going to make is navy bean soup with sauerkraut and chorizo.
It is wonderful. I mean, you're going to love it. I mean, these are all old family recipes, not old family recipes. It's what I cook for my family, and robust, and you know, and also very seasonal. I am very fortunate to have worked. One of my old friends is a Hong Kong Chinese lady called Romy, and she helped me because, of course, what she brought was, as they say in China, you know, when you greet somebody in China, you don't say hello, how are you? Are you in route?
Have you had rice?
That's right. Have you eaten? And the respect for food in China is intimate to their culture and their society. And if somebody's ill, they don't go to the medicine cabinet; they go to the kitchen. And if it's seasonal, they think about the seasonal elements of whether you should be hunkering down for the winter or whether you should be rising up as if you're germinating in the spring. And food should, you know, and I don't obsess about that. Please don't, you know, gentle readers, please don't think that I'm obsessing about, you know, what you should eat. What I'm saying is that you should at least have some respect for the natural rhythms of your region, of your locale, and eat accordingly.
I agree. And there are many recipes here that I really want to set out. You pick these ingredients for the recipes that I'm really in love with, like fresh mackerel and miso and ginger. I mean, these are things that I view as, I mean, I crave them, actually. So
yes.
Did you see the breakfast fry up with the kidneys in it?
No, I missed that. That's Peter's kind of thing.
I don't have a source. I can't find anywhere to buy them.
Kidneys.
Well, you see, don't forget, I mean, what you said about craving, isn't that wonderful to use that word without any sort of sense of guilt? You know, you crave it for the right reasons.
Right. Well, I went through a phase where I chewed lobster shells. Eventually, I got past that, but I think I must have had an iodine deficiency.
you also got sick.
I got sick.
I think this also touches upon the current obsession amongst those who have lost their relationship with food, which I'm afraid to say is the majority of the Western world, and increasingly in other parts of the world, is this idea that food is either dirty or clean, or that food is either good or bad, or that you are feeling guilty, and so on. And of course, what this does is just it creates fear and anxiety.
Yes.
Without referencing, you know, the true knowledge of our ancestors as to food, and the respect for food. Now we've got so much choice, so much so-called advice that we're now completely and utterly bewildered as to what is clean or dirty or right or wrong. And in Eat Right, I've set out to say, look, I am not going to put myself in a position of dietary arrogance. I'm just going to say, embrace your regional, your local, your ancestral understanding of food, and you'll feel much better for it.
And Nick Barnard, I believe I would be happy to have dinner with you anytime.
I would cherish that. I think we would find it difficult to find time to eat because we'd have so many stories to tell.
That's probably true too. At any rate, let's repeat the name of this book, Eat Right. And listeners, I think it's just the foundation of what you should be doing to get your life in sync at this point. Nick Barnard, of Root Health, thank you for doing this book. It was a lot of work, and thank you for talking to us about it.
And what do we say, Rule Britannia?
Rule Britannia.
Yes, I suppose so, but I'm very pleased to say that my journey to write this book is much a tribute to all those farmers and chefs and teachers and inspirational people of the likes of yourselves who really give us hope that we can have a regenerative and conscious relationship with food again. So thank you.
Thank you.
Oh.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Might be wondering what's in the future. We know what we're supposed to be eating right now. We have James McWilliams with his crystal ball and his research.
And a really, really rather contrary point of view.
He's talking about eating promiscuously.
And so you have to listen to find out what that means.
Well, and basically we're going to be talking about eating options of future populations, and you may not like it. James McWilliams, I must tell you that from experience we've discovered that some of the best food writers around are historians, which you are.
Well, that's good to hear. Thanks. I think because historians tend to bring, well, a kind of greater context to what they're looking at and can maybe offer layers of analysis that, you know, if you're just writing about it from the present perspective, it's harder to do. So I appreciate that.
Well, you've written 7 books, but this one's really, I'd say it's explosive in its implications of what we should be doing. It's called Eating Promiscuously, Adventures in the Future of Food. Let's start with what is wrong with our current agricultural scene.
Well, pretty much everything. I mean, I hate to be so dismissive and kind of sweeping in my analysis, but it is a food system that has been reduced to just a handful of crops. And, you know, we walk into a grocery store under the illusion that we've never had greater diversity or greater options at our fingertips, and it certainly appears that way. But the minute you start looking at the ingredients that are in our food, it becomes very clear that we're just eating different variations of, you know, corn, soy, domesticated animal products. And, you know, as a result, the foods that our body, you know, has evolved to eat don't exist for us anymore, or we don't make them available anymore, you know, even though we could. And this is happening with vegetables as well. The genetic diversity of our vegetables is getting increasingly narrowed. The number of vegetables that we eat is getting increasingly narrowed. And when it comes to thinking about an optimal healthy diet, which a lot of, you know, people are starting to think about, particularly if you can afford to think that way, what's really kind of ironic and frustrating is that no matter how hard we try, our food system simply does not allow us to eat as well as we might eat, and I would say as well as we have a right to eat, because food companies and corporations and, you know, consumer demand have conspired to narrow our food system to such a small handful of unhealthy foods that we really don't have much to work with right now. And so my motivation in this book was to kind of explore some ways we might think very differently our food system. And I actually start the book with this kind of thought experiment where we kind of go, well, okay, wait a minute. Agriculture has only been around a tiny, tiny period of human existence. And, you know, why would we think that we got it right the first time? Like most things in human experience, we get things wrong before we get it right. And, you know, my premise is that we just got agriculture fundamentally wrong, and that we now are in a position to rethink building an entirely new system from scratch.
Now, what you're saying is, in a sense, we only have ourselves to blame, because we're allowing ourselves to be tugged by the nose to some place where we shouldn't be, and we should be resisting that.
Yeah, I think we're in a unique position right now where we can resist that. I mean, one of the things I really try hard not to do in the book is assign blame, even though that's done a lot, and I certainly could have done that. I think we have inherited a situation as, you know, humans living in the postmodern world. We've inherited a culinary situation that, you know, most people today have absolutely nothing to do with. I mean, we can't account for the last, you know, as individuals, we can't consider ourselves responsible for the last, you know, 10,000 years of food production. It's just not something that you can kind of point to anybody and say, hey, this is your fault. And so in some ways, I kind of exonerate everybody and say, look, we are in a situation that is in, you know, is not necessarily due to any single corporation or government or consumer group or whoever you want to point the finger at. And instead, you know, instead of assigning blame and fighting over who we should blame for the situation that we're in, I instead try to promote the idea that we have the resources, we certainly have the perspective, and I think increasingly the motivation to say, hey, we can rebuild a new system from scratch. What might that look like? What kind of principles would we pursue? What could a future food system look like so that we didn't have to work so hard to eat well within the system that surrounds us?
Well, you go further than that, and you say basically that we need to wipe out everything so that we could start all over. Now, I didn't really, in what I read in your book, understand how we were going to accomplish that.
Well, of course we're not. I mean, this is a thought experiment. And, I mean, I've been writing about food now for 15 years, and I've been writing about the contemporary food industry for that long, and I'm under no illusion that somebody can come along and make that happen. But in order to start thinking creatively about what could be and the kind of radical solutions that we might pursue to replace the systems that are now in place, I think it's really a useful way to think. It's kind of an imaginative gambit where you sort of say, well, what if we could start over? So it's not as if I am working under the impression that this is going to happen. It's more, hey, how can we start to spark our thinking and motivate our thinking in the right direction? And that just kind of struck me as a productive thought experiment to pursue in order to get food reformers to think bigger about food reform. I think there are tons of people right now, incredibly intelligent people, thinking about how to fix the food system. My argument is they're trying to fix it from within the system, and that is not working very well. So if we want to start thinking about fixing, or rather replacing, the food system, then we, you know, might do very well to entertain the idea of beginning with a blank slate, even though, of course, in reality, one doesn't exist.
Right. Well, I mean, there is a point to be had about two things. Evolution, and, I mean, what is this? Maybe we evolved to these particular tastes, but there's also the point of no return is how do we go back to this clean slate place?
And so instead of trying to think about going back to a time when we had access to, you know, not dozens of foods, but hundreds of foods, and I'm thinking in particular of hunter-gathering situations, which, you know, I mean, there are a lot of people today, particularly people who pursue the paleo diet, who do, I think, envision a kind of return to a hunter-gatherer way of eating. Mm-hmm. And I have mixed feelings about that. On the one hand, I love the idea of thinking about eating more diversely, of eating a wider range of foods, of eating wilder foods. I think all of that is a very good idea. But on the other hand, yeah, we can't really go back to that situation. So what I try to do is take this notion of diversity and culinary diversity and ask, hey, how can modern technology bring us that? I don't want to spend my days going out hunting and gathering, and, you know, very few people I know do. So how can we, this is what I meant earlier when I said, how can we draw on the resources that we now have at our disposal for the first time in human history to kind of engineer a food system that enables us to eat a, you know, incredibly wide array of foods that in some ways approximates and perhaps even exceeds the kind of dietary diversity that were enjoyed by hunter-gatherer societies who, as far as we can tell by a great deal of archaeological evidence, have ate very well and had diets that were entirely conducive to their human bodies, which, you know, I think today we have the opposite. We have diets that are completely out of whack
with our
human bodies.
You devote a major section of your introduction to the issues of health as a result of obesity, and you trace the history of obesity, which I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, and so obesity throughout most of human history was a rarity. It's something that people not see very often, and then there are certain points in history where obesity, because it was rare, became a sign of status and wealth and prosperity.
You
and, of course, now,
Rubens.
You know, with the 35% of Americans obese and 65% of Americans overweight, chronic epidemic. And the reason why is because our bodies haven't changed that much over time. I mean, we still have the bodies that evolved to move 10 miles a day and to eat a wide range of foods. And we sit and we eat these foods that are just densely packed with starch and sugar and foods that are calorically dense but not nutritionally dense. And it's just, you know, no wonder that we become obese. But these foods are so new, these industrialized foods are so new that they've kind of snuck up on us. And, I mean, even in the last 30 years, the numbers are incredible in terms of how quickly we have become overweight as a society. And I present this as, this is not a book that assigns blame. I actually think we're very, very few of us have the ability to negotiate with any sort of success.
Yeah. Now, you express admiration for Dan Barber. In fact, we were just in Melbourne, Australia with him, Dan, and we had breakfast with him. And the third plate.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
what he's doing is he's tinkering in the sense of returning to again.
Yeah, and I really, I mean, as you know from the book, have a great deal of admiration for Dan Barber and the idea of simplifying our diet in a way that makes it more accessible to more people is very appealing to me. And I think that's a value I very much share with Dan Barber and that I've learned from Dan Barber and the third. One of the chefs that I interviewed for my book was very much an acolyte of Dan Barber and tried to work a lot of Barber's culinary philosophy into his own cooking. Now, I think where I probably differ a little bit from Barber is I'm much less interested in looking backwards as I am looking forward and kind of taking the genetic technologies that we have perfected and used for all the wrong purposes and tried to think about ways to use those technologies to create more genetic diversity in the foods that we eat, more nutrient density in the foods that we eat.
Do you have an
trying
example
to create
of that?
Foods that we can grow under more controlled conditions so we don't have to be so vulnerable to the elements as farmers are today. And all these possibilities are out there. They're just not being pursued because of the dominance of the corn, soy, domesticated animal complex.
Well, I mean, I asked you earlier about what if you changed in your own diet, and you said that you've been ordering a cricket flour from Colorado, and that's the major producer of cricket flour now, eating more oysters. I love oysters. I'd eat all the oysters going, but of course the issue is we're depleting the oyster population, and climate change is warming the waters, so there are more parasites and whatnot in oysters. So
everything you just said about depleting the oceans and over harvesting is true, with the exception of oysters. I mean, it's true for almost all marine life, mm-hmm. which is why I have very little hope for a future human diet based on fish. But oysters are different because oysters. Let's separate the issues here. The warming waters are one thing, and that's something that in certain parts of the world is going to be an issue with certain parasites and the safety of oysters. Now, where I went, which was in Cape Cod, I interviewed oyster farmers in Cape Cod who do not have that problem. The waters are still extremely cold around Cape Cod, and they're actually perfect for the oyster industry. And there's no issue here of depleting the oyster population because these are farmed oysters. These are oysters that they are growing on farms out off the Cape, and they clean the water. Oysters filter nitrogen out of the water, and so there have been really conclusive studies showing that as oyster farms proliferate around Cape Cod and other parts of New England that the quality of the water improves dramatically, and you start to see a recovery of marine life around these oyster beds. So there is a very good argument to be made that we should be eating more oysters to foster environmental progress.
I'm right in line there. We just got back from Sydney, where I love Sydney oysters. I ate tons of them.
Yeah. I mean, and they are delicious. Now, the other thing I would say about oysters, though, is the notion of eating them fresh is a kind of a rarity. I mean, we should probably become accustomed to eating them kind of smoked, because one of the key elements of my argument is that what, you know, we entertain and think about as essential to the future of the human diet should be accessible to as many people as possible.
Okay, so we're coming to this issue of two things that you bring up is we should be eating more seaweed. Actually, we've been connected to a seaweed farmer in Maine, and I've been cooking seaweed almost on a daily basis.
I interviewed a seaweed farmer in Steuben, Maine.
Is he called Mr. What's he called? Is the seaweed?
Yeah, man. Large Hansen.
Right? Yeah, Large. That's who. Yes.
Okay, and so I spent the day with him, and I, you know, left entirely. Not only did I leave with a big bag of seaweed that I
I have one of those boxes full of seaweed.
I left entirely convinced that this must be an essential food in the future, in the future human diet. I mean, in terms of its versatility, it's a great basis for the kind of foods we should be eating, like soups and stews, and it's quite healthy. And if it's when it is harvested sustainably, and this is a kind of a big political issue right now, but when it is harvested sustainably, it's very good for the oceans, much like oyster farming is. And so it is also an endeavor that can be done by, you know, individually massive seaweed harvesters to do this. This can be done on a small scale operation by a lot of independent farmers, which is also, I think, appealing to a lot of people. So there are many, many good things that seaweed has going for it. There's also a great diversity of seaweeds.
He sent me a bunch of types that I've been trying to match them up with the recipe book he has. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just looking over to her, and she's looking a little green around the edges.
Larch, you know, who I interviewed, Larch Hansen, is probably one of the most knowledgeable people about seaweed harvesting in the country. He's been doing it for 40 years. He works independently, sometimes gets a little bit of help. The other thing that I really think is fascinating about it is it really requires the farmer to kind of engage with the environment in a real way. I mean, he goes out in his boat, he harvests this stuff, he hauls it in, he's remarkably fit, as you can imagine.
He's,
you know, I think he's in his 70s, and so
is he that old? Because he's gorgeous. I have pictures of him. Yeah,
he looks like Paul Newman. He's got that going for him as well. But he's a really remarkably inspiring guy. And
you know what? He looks a lot like my husband.
Well, there you go.
She's trying to make up for lost time here. She really doesn't mean it at all.
I do.
But I have been cooking some delicious soups with the seaweed that I took from Larch's farm, and I've been purchasing seaweed online from various places.
It's expensive.
As well. So, you know, and related to this is algae. I haven't started to do stuff with algae yet, but there are some algae farms and people that are starting to cook with algae. And you know, these are the kind of endeavors I think we need to be pursuing and supporting more as consumers.
Well, it's expensive. I mean, this seaweed is expensive.
It is right now, but that's because there's not much of it out there, and I think that it could be scaled up. Larch would not agree with me, but I think this stuff could be farmed. He's a purist. He would not want that to happen, but, you know, I could someday see this being grown under artificial conditions, and, you know, I think like anything, if you scale it up enough, I think it could become affordable. It certainly is cheaper and easier to produce than beef, that's for sure. And, you know, not that the two are that interchangeable in terms of how we eat, but I think it's something that right now is expensive because it is so rare. But with more demand, I think you'd see the price go down.
Now, let's operate within certain parameter limits here. So before we close, what about crickets?
Yeah, I was going to say the other idea is insects, and I have been trying very hard to deal with that, and I can't seem to overcome the mental
Yeah, it's pretty ironic because, I mean, humans have been eating insects probably forever, more than any other animal throughout, you know, history. And, there are currently, I don't know, like, there are currently about 2,500 known edible insects. Obviously, only a few of them are harvested and commercialized for food, ants and crickets mainly. They, in my experience, are quite tasty. Their nutrient profile is incredible. These are incredibly healthy foods to eat. They're cheap to produce. They're very low environmental impact. And, I mean, on and on and on, these foods have so many things going for them. The kind of ick factor is, I think, one that people will get over in time. I mean, I make a pancake where I now use one-third cricket flour instead of regular flour. And, you know, when you eat that, you're getting a much more nutritious pancake, but it's also got cricket flour in it. Most people wouldn't tell the difference. I mean, there's a little bit of a flavor there, but most people wouldn't know. Not that I'm suggesting we should food, but in terms of taste, in terms of the quality of the food, and you put the stuff in the hands of a good chef, and I think most people can get over the squeamishness pretty quickly.
Well, I hope so. I mean, they've had bug dinners and so forth, and I just I ordered a new book called Eating Bugs, and a video comes with it, and it's bugs from around the world. And you talk about an ick factor. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to get through watching it all. I mean, I've seen them in the markets of Central America, you know, the things, and which it grabs in Australia and so forth. And it's very odd to me, but I can't get over this.
Well, you know, again, I think in time, given how resource intensive it is to produce cows and pigs and a little less so chickens, but nonetheless chickens, you know, we might not have a choice. I mean, if we want to eat animals, these might be the only animals that we can eat in terms of the available resources.
Right.
But that wouldn't be so bad. Like I said, there are thousands of flavors that we're missing out on because we narrow our diet so radically. And I think that's perhaps the most exciting message to take away from my book is, hey, we're missing out on thousands of flavors that we could have access to. It's not, and so when we think about giving up things like beef or, you know, pork or chicken, and we think, oh, how could I ever do that? Well, you have to imagine having access to a wide range of delicious flavors that we don't even know about yet. And I think, you know, those can and will be pursued someday.
Well, I think that it's a great launching pad for your imagination and how you are motivated to eat in the future. And I congratulate you, James McWilliams. Again, the book is Eating Promiscuously, which is a great title, by the way.
Thank you.
And let us know when your next book is out.
Well, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, so there you have it. Three very different points of view about the future of food. We hope you learn something. We certainly enjoyed talking to these fine gentlemen and finding out what they thought, and we hope you did too, and that you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.